And we're recording. So I'm Wesley Jones, and
I'm Stephanie Lumsden,
and I'm Rick Hodge.
Right. So we're here to conduct an oral history about you, yourself, and your association with the Rosetown Ramblers.
Right.
So yeah, let's get started. I think what we wanted to do is go ahead and start with a little of your own background and what led you to become part of the Rosetown Ramblers. So
okay.
We'll start with a few basics just to warm up.
Sure.
So when and where were you born at?
I was born in Needham, Massachusetts, which is a town about 10 miles outside of Boston, in November 9th, 1950.
Oh. And how long did you... Did you say it was Needle?
Needham.
Needham.
N-E-E-D-H-A-M.
Right. And how long did you stay there?
I graduated from high school in 68. I was commuting to the University of Massachusetts in Boston for, I think, 2 years before I found my own place in Boston and left home. Actually, in those days, well, you don't know Boston, but... there's downtown, there's Boston Garden, Boston Common, then there's the Public Gardens, which is where the swan boats and stuff. The next street after that is Arlington, and running to either side of that is Berkeley and Commonwealth. Well, Commonwealth runs into the middle of it. Anyway, I lived on Berkeley Street, about half a block south of the, half a block down from the Public Garden. So I was right downtown, and my room in an old brownstone cost me $25 a week.
Oh.
Wow,
so
nice.
Wow.
Yeah, you couldn't touch that now.
No. So Boston's a long way from Portland. How'd you end up all the way over here?
The only time my number has ever come up in a lottery was the draft lottery in 1971. It was the last one they had. My number was 80. And that was just low enough, high enough. And I got drafted, and you had your choice in those days. You could allow yourself to be drafted or you could enlist, and I ran around to all of the recruiters, which was a trip. You've never heard such a lying in your life, bald-faced lying. The Army wanted to give me $1,100 to enlist with the Army and become go into small arms maintenance, which was a quick trip to Vietnam, which was not something I was looking for. The Air Force and the Navy recruiters had adjoining offices and listened through the wall to each other. The Navy guy was telling me about all the travel and how I'd hate going to basic training in Texas because of the Gila monsters and rattlesnakes. The Air Force guy was saying that's bullshit, and you go with the Navy, you'll be on a ship, and you may see the land, but you're never going to get off the damn ship for 6 months at a time. And I always knew... There was a movie, John Carpenter did a remake of The Thing a few years ago. Well, the original was at a remote radar site in Alaska, and they find an alien spacecraft under the ice, and the vegetable man that's in there gets loose and kills everybody. Actually played by James Arness, who was later Matt Dillon on Gunsmoke. But somehow I knew from the moment I saw that movie when I was a little kid, I always knew someday I would be at a remote radar station somewhere, and I ended up in the Air Force and got tossed out of air traffic control training because I'm very, very slightly red-green colorblind, which I didn't know until then, and ended up as what we called a scope dope, sitting in front of a radar screen watching airplanes go around for... about 3 years in Tacoma, and a year sitting on top of a mountain up 65 miles north of Fairbanks. But at the time I got out of the Air Force, my wife, who was living in Tigard here with her aunt and uncle, was pregnant, was working for U.S. National Bank and had benefits. And me getting out of the Air Force, jobless, benefitless, it just seemed to make sense to stay right here.
And so how long were you in the...
I was in the Air Force for 4 years, from 72 until 76.
And so where did life take you from there?
I had not graduated from UMass. Those days, Moratorium Day after Kent State. There was big ruckus in colleges, and my school was a commuter school. There were no dormitories for UMass in Boston at the time, so most of us were working class kids, and just weren't. We were there to get the education and not interested in all the politics swirling around at the time. So comes Kent State and every other college in Boston, and there are lots of them, are all voting to strike, and all the student bodies are walking out. We fiddled and farted, and finally the faculty at UMass said, screw this, we're going on strike, so do whatever you want. So between that sort of nonsense, and I didn't graduate before ending up in the Air Force, and the first thing I did after the Air Force was got a job at JAFCO, which is long gone. They sold cameras and electronics and whatever. Spent a year doing that to make sure I had my residency in Oregon, and then I went to Fort State. Year and a half there, finished up, and I got an urban studies certificate from Portland State. I had majors in sociology and a minor in English, and I think I almost had a major in psych too at the time, but I wanted to go into urban planning. Mm-hmm. And after looking at it for a while and realizing that with urban planning, you either work for the city and do what the politicians tell you,
right,
or you work for the developers and do what they tell you and screw your conscience. And with a with a baby and a wife and in need of a job, I said the hell with it and applied with the state and ended up commuting to Salem for 30 years, working as a research analyst for the employment department.
Wow.
So I kept track of, my job was to keep track of every unemployment claim that was filed, whether it was paid or denied, if it was denied, why, if it was paid, how many times it was paid, how much it was paid, and doing this for however many unemployment programs we were running at the moment, the basics ones with all the extensions and all the little ones. So after 30 years of that and working with people in Salem, I had had so I bailed out because I'm a tier one state, was a tier one state employee. I got the benefit of being able to retire at 55 or 30 years or some kind. Anyway, I waited for the 29 and a half years and I was 57, 58. Anyway, it was enough. I'd had it up to there and then some, so gone. And I don't regret it, I don't miss it, and I don't care.
So when did you get involved with the Ramblers? Or how did you hear about that?
What brought that about?
Roll back the calendar. See, 84. Yeah, it was about 1984 that having been married for 12 years or so, you reach your period, it's time to give that up and come out, which I did. And passing over all that horrendous nonsense, I ended up, I got a place on Northwest 19th. As the Northwest at the time was the gay ghetto, that's where everybody was. It hadn't gone too pricey yet. But the building I was in was on 19th, and next to it was a parking lot. There's a church across the street. And across the parking lot was the Northwest Service Center. Well, at this time I was hanging out or going to a regular group meeting of gay fathers, which seemed like a sensible way to get into things. And sometime in 1984, and I can't remember quite when it was, they were all enthusiastic about square dancing, and they were going to the square dance convention in Seattle. Square dancing is what you did in high school, and who cares? They went, and they all had a hell of a good time, apparently. I heard endless stories. So in the fall of 84, which is when the Ramblers were starting their fall class, that would have been their second year, one of the guys from that was, well, you should come over, the class is starting tonight. Wash my hair, I've got to, no. Nah. Did the same thing the second week, and again, no. And the third week, I said, fine, the hell with it, I've got no excuse, I'm a block away. I went over. Overcame my reluctance to do something as weird as square dancing. And, you know, it once you let that go, it was fun. I had a good time, so I kept coming back to the classes. The guy that forced me to go disappeared. And I just got into it. I wasn't ever much of a bar person. Mm-hmm. I'm not much of a drinker, and the whole, the atmosphere in the bars in the 80s was a little too intense, frankly. And this was as AIDS was coming on, mm-hmm. but it hadn't really touched Portland yet. So people were, you were kind of aware of it, but it wasn't a big deal. In any case, with the square dancing, I found it much easier to actually meet people. Mm-hmm. Now you're doing something, you're actively involved with at least 8-7 other people in that square, with all the other people around as well. You didn't need partners, you didn't have to dress funny, all you had to do was learn the calls and have fun. There was I think there was only one woman really involved in the club at the time. And she was all enthusiastic about the Seattle convention she'd gone to, and there was one coming up in Denver, which would have been the second one. And she wanted the Ramblers to do a convention too. And she talked us all into it, went to Denver, which was my first convention, had a hell of a good time, and the person who was supposed to have gone to the board meeting of the International Association of Gay Square Dance Clubs to present our bid, in the year I'd known him, I realized that he was a major flake. And I stuck my head in the room where the board meeting was just to see if he'd shown up to tell him we wanted to do the convention. And he hadn't. So I just invited myself in, sat down, and since that board meeting in 1984, I have missed one board meeting.
Wow.
As well as pretty much running two conventions, multiple fly-ins, other events, chairing the association, and doing the medallion stuff as well. So
for those of us who may not know a lot about the Rosetown Ramblers, yeah. What can you tell us about the Rosetown Ramblers and how, you know, what are they, what do they do, how to get involved, and, you know, different aspects?
Okay, well, getting to years straight is the hard part. Somewhere back in the late 70s, there was a group in Florida. They were vaguely interested in square dancing, and there were 24 of them. They had three squares, and each square was sponsored by a different bar, and this turned into some sort of competitive thing. So they all learned, they had a record, and they learned what was on the record and learned to dance that. And that fell apart eventually, and they sort of amalgamated into a single square dance club. Mm-hmm. And decided that instead of just learning a record, they got involved with the, it's called Sets in Order, and it's the published list of modern Western square dance calls as put together by Caller Lab, which is an organization of callers. So they put together the list of calls and the definitions and separated into programs, like basic program, mainstream program, plus advanced two, challenge 1, 2, 3, and whatever. So they decided to learn that. A couple of people from there moved, one to Denver, and I forget where the other one went to. But they were the nucleus. So from them, there were clubs forming in Denver and Phoenix. San Francisco had its own thing going on. And Seattle and Vancouver. And it spread to Portland. So there was a group in Portland that was helped by some people in Seattle learn how to do this. They started the Rosetown Ramblers in 84. The first year, they had a caller, a woman from somewhere down the valley who was a brand new square dance caller. And she was willing to call for this bunch of gay guys, even though it caused her no end of problems with the straight square dance community. and no end of problems did she have with the gay community either. There were apparently a couple of people in that first group that were bitchy to the max and thought they knew. Anyway, they drove her away after their first year, and the Ramblers didn't think they were going to have another class. Two of the guys, Robert Hodge and Paul Kilgore, I think, thought, well, we've got the list of calls. We've got these records from Jack Lazary that take you through the whole list of calls. And the Lazary records would teach you the call and then run you through it and keep adding on to it. And they thought that they knew enough about the calls that they could help teach the class that way. And that's the one that I got pulled into. And as it went along, there were a couple of other guys who had apparently thought the whole thing was over because they didn't have a caller. Larry Murkison and Clint something, can't remember his name. They decided, okay, this seems to be working, we want back in. So for a while we had four different teachers who would fight for time to be teacher. There were a lot of egos involved at the time, and some of the board meetings with the Ramblers just turned into screaming matches. It was not fun to be around. What I've found with all the square dancing over these years is it's true of any social organization, it's true of academic organizations as well, is that the more trivial the matter, the more violent the temper. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it went. But I was interested enough. I enjoyed doing it. I liked most of the people that we were square dancing with. And then going out of town to Seattle or the convention in Denver, you meet a lot more people, and it starts building up. You have a lot more fun, mm-hmm. and the temperamental issues sort of even out because you've got more people to spread them around.
Right.
I guess I wanted to ask you, Rick, the relationships you've built, the friendships and everything you've built during your time with the Ramblers, like, what has that meant for your life or your survival, I guess?
Well, I don't know where I'd be if I hadn't done this. I can't think of anything else I would have got involved in as much. Here there was sort of my temperament. There were vacuums in organization and a place to stick your oar in the water and get some control over the situation. That meeting in Denver, right? Didn't trust the person to show up and stuck my head in the door. That led to a whole raft of things. And with the Ramblers, As some people got bored with it and moved on, and it always needed to get more people in, so there's the recruiting aspect of it, and then nobody wants to be president forever because you've got responsibilities, so eventually you get on the board and you become the president, and it's your responsibility, and I liked that. It was much more fun than work. Mm-hmm. And something in the community gave me a chance to get to know these other people and around the country. Mm-hmm. And Canada, and even Japan, oddly enough. So these days, not that I'm traveling much at the moment while I'm working on the house, but if I wanted to, there's some sort of gay square dance thing going on somewhere in the country or Canada almost every weekend of the year. And I could be doing those, and most of the time I wouldn't need to pay for a hotel because I know somebody in that city who'd put me up. So,
wow.
Lots of advantages to that. And some of this, the convention aspect of it, I had, for years before gay square dancing, I'd been involved with science fiction conventions. Mm-hmm. With the Portsmouth crowd here in Portland, many of whom I still hang out with, and going to science fiction conventions. So as our convention for Portland came up, I was sufficiently familiar with convention organization that even though it was not my time politically to be the chair of that convention, I was sort of the behind the throne chair of the convention, telling them how this needs to be organized and how you need to do this and this and something else. So And I got my chance to do it my own way completely in 98 when we did it again.
Wow. So now this, you joined in 84.
Yep.
And now shortly after were the different measures, late 80s, early 90s, that were put on by the Oregon?
Lon Mabon.
OCA.
The OCA. How did those affect not only you, but the Rosetown Ramblers? Were there any hardships that came about from that, or any discriminations?
None really that affected us. I mean, square dancing is a pretty insular little world. Mm-hmm. And you know, people had their own politics, but a lot of us couldn't take Lon Mabon and company seriously. We didn't do too much actively to oppose any of that. I mean, mm-hmm. We were just there.
Right.
We did on a couple of occasions. I remember the first one. We went to visit a straight square dance group out in Tualatin. Mm-hmm. Yes, we knew somebody who was part of that group, and she said, "Oh, it'll be fine. Don't worry about it." So we all put on our club shirts, which were plain blue Western shirts at the time, and we all showed up at the Grange out in Tualatin, much to the surprise of many of the people who were there. Some of whom didn't realize who or what we were, mm-hmm. and a few who did. And a large percentage of the people there just went along with it just fine. So we were representing ourselves out in the straight community. And as time has gone on, and as we've had more dance experience, and as we've moved up in the programs, you get to a certain point where people don't care who you are, mm-hmm. as long as you can dance.
Right.
Or a lot of the straight groups, there are single women because their husbands have died. Mm-hmm. And if they don't have a partner, frequently they don't dance. And if we show up, we don't generally show up as partners or with partners, so we're always a free guy to dance with.
Right.
And there was an incident one night at a straight function out by Capitol Hill. The woman and her husband who ran that were fun, and they enjoyed having us around. We were younger than they were. She did, what's the proper term for it? Well, she and her husband were in a square over here, mm-hmm. and there were several of us in a square over here. And she and her husband jumped from that square into this square. So two guys in this square jumped into their square to take their place. And things were okay until it came around that one of the straight men was going to have to swing one of the gay men. And he just got this look on his face, and he stopped, and he stepped back out of the square and put his arms across his chest and just stood there. And square dance etiquette, you do not, under any circumstances, leave a square. So they finished up without him, and then the Doris, the woman who was sort of running things, went over to him, shoved her finger in his face, and read him the riot act for what he did, for why he did it. And her husband had to come and pull her away, but then her husband got in the middle of it, and he was given a metaphor too. And we never had a problem after that.
And what was that act you mentioned?
It was a straight square dance, and I don't know if they had a name for the event at the time. It was just one of their weekly or monthly dances.
And the...
Well, the first time we'd gone to the straight square dance things, we would go with our own square.
Uh-huh.
So that we wouldn't force anybody else to put up with us. One of the ones that really broke the water. There were maybe six or eight squares on the floor, and the caller was doing something. And everybody on the square, when you screw something up and the square falls apart because you're not following the calls, it's called a breakdown. Every of these six or eight squares, every square except ours kept breaking down. And the caller was just exasperated, and he finally pointed back at us and said, "Just do what they're doing." And after that, these straight couples would come and ask us to dance in their squares. because we were good, we could be trusted to dance fine, and the gay aspect of it was just shoved to the side.
Right.
So, I guess, was it important then, as far as gay square dancing and going to, like, straight dances, was it important to have allies like this woman who shoved her finger in that guy's face?
It didn't hurt. It made us feel more comfortable. In some ways, I think maybe we were more uncomfortable going to their event than they were with us being there. And we didn't know, you know, what to expect. It's a few of us against a lot of them, so they could have made it very uncomfortable, but they never did. You know, they might have been a bit curious, but eventually quite accepting and just fine.
So what were, thinking back on some of your experiences that you've had, good and bad, you know, what are your fondest memories? We'll start with the good.
Yeah, the fondest. Good. Or most wild memories.
Yeah.
Well, I remember that the Denver convention, since that was my first really out-of-town square dance thing with a whole bunch of, and it was mostly gay men at the time. Mm-hmm. I think even today, it still runs about 80% men to 20% women. And for years, it was a struggle to keep women in the ramp. What would happen? We'd have our first few nights of lessons that were free to get people in. And on the first night, two women, individuals, would show up. But they didn't know each other, and they're surrounded by men. Well, clearly, they were uncomfortable, and the next week, they wouldn't be there. And then the next week, two more women would show up, and they'd look around, and no women, and they'd leave. So it was a struggle to get women sufficiently interested to stay so that you've got that little core that when women do come, they will see other women there and will stay. But Denver was really my first big social event that was really gay. Mm-hmm. And people seemed to be quite normal. Yeah, well, put quotes around. The whole drag thing never did anything for me. I always thought it was pretty weird, and it took me a while to get used to it. But at that Denver convention, there was a guy named Freeman Stamper, who was well over 6 feet to begin with. And Freeman appeared in his very high heels, with the big poofy dress with all the crinolines under it, mm-hmm. And outrageous hair. So he was easily 7 foot tall and all of this stuff, with flags sticking out of his hair. And he and a number of his friends from San Francisco were the Bradley family. So dancing with men dressed in crinolines and big hair got to be fun fairly quickly.
Yeah.
And then knowing the person underneath all of the jazz was just, okay, all right, this is just something they like to do, mm-hmm. and I don't have to care for it myself very much, but they're having fun, so what the hell, why not? And one of the men in the Ramblers, it was the family zoo one night, and a friend of mine, Dennis, came in, and there was a woman with him, and very vivacious, and it took me a few minutes to realize that that woman that he was with was actually a guy named Jim, mm-hmm. Who Jim was this very, very mild, shy, almost withdrawn, chubby little bald guy, but put the wig on and the dress, and he was a completely different person. And he was the first person I know to have the surgery and the whole transition thing, which we all had to go through with him. And please, there are some things I do not need to see, although we had to. So yeah, it was a learning process, and square dancing helped me get more comfortable with a lot of aspects of the gay world that were either off-putting or just mm-hmm. not my thing. So that's a good thing to come from square dancing. And some of my other good moments, you know, the Denver convention, the Grand March, when all the clubs come in at the opening ceremonies in San Francisco in 86, was a wonderful Grand March. The enthusiasm was just incredible. Everybody, it was wonderful. Didn't have another one like that until the 10th convention in Seattle, where the UW and we used the courtyard, big brick courtyard for the mm-hmm. Grand March, and that was great. We had huge banners and very exciting. The convention we had here in Portland in 87, people would not believe it if I said so now, but I was a very shy kid and relatively shy person, and I was president of the Ramblers that year, and I had to sort of give a welcoming speech. And I'd never spoken, the last time I'd spoken in front of a group of people was maybe in eighth, that was in high school when I had to recite a speech from Shakespeare, Cleopatra, and I just, it was a horrible experience. So here I am again, I've got to say something, and I realized, you know, I've met all these people, 650 people out there, and I've pretty much met them all, so I'm just talking to my friends. I just happen to be up on a stage with a microphone, and get over it. So my first public speaking experience was in front of a square dance crowd, and that's how I got through it, and they're hesitant to let me anywhere near a microphone anymore, but because I do this medallion thing in Chicago this year, at the opening ceremonies, I will have to give a little speech and give away the 20-year medallions. Then at the banquet later in the week, later in the weekend, then I will present the 10-year medallions. So I get the microphone again in front of 1,000, 1,100, 1,200 people. And then I have to introduce the medallion tip, which is a tip is a singing call and a patter call. And it's so they do a special thing for the medallion recipient, so they want me to introduce that. I'll be at the board meeting, as usual, and there in the past, they have threatened to bring a ball gag to shut me out. so I get a lot of microphone time these days, and I have no trouble standing up in front of a bunch of people and just blathering on endlessly. So that's been one of the major things from square dancing, is that I've overcome whatever fear of crowds and stage and public speaking I ever had.
That's good.
Do you have any, I don't know, I guess you used the word bitchy earlier.
It's appropriate. It's very
appropriate. Any, I don't know, I don't want to say politics with the Ramblers, but like you were saying, like animosity or something.
Oh, God, yes. And when I first started with the Ramblers, it was just, again, social organization, everybody wants to have their say, and some people are louder than others, and some people just are going to shout everybody down. It was very uncomfortable a lot of times. But you still had to get along with people. There were some people that you got along with less than other people.
Right.
And maybe avoided. and my history with my history with the Ramblers has been up and down. There was the year after we did our convention in 87, I was elected chair of the association that year. And I was supposed to be teaching the basic class in the fall, which, again, I'm not a square dance caller, but I knew the calls and I could walk people through. At the last minute, the newly elected board of the Ramblers pulled me aside and said that, and this sort of came out of their mouths in a rush. Since I'd been elected chair of the association, they thought I'd be much too busy to teach the class, and they were going to let this other person do it. And oh, by the way, all the stuff I had left over from the convention, they wanted me to bring it the next week.
Oh.
And I, well, okay, fine, you can do what you want, but if you want the stuff from the convention, which is leftover coffee mugs and all sorts of paperwork, and fine, you can come and get it. I'm not going to bring it to you. So for the next year, the year that I was chair of the association, the Ramblers had pretty much shoved me out the door. And my partner and I showed up at a dance late that year, Rose Festival time, mm-hmm. that they were having at, was it Portland State? I'm not sure whether it was Lincoln Hall or Smith. Anyway, we were there, and somebody from Portland walked up and asked us where we'd come from. you know, do we come to Portland often? And then I said, oh, no, actually, we live in Portland. We just haven't been around much this year. And that group of people that were running around was that year. Well, of the four of them, basically four of them, two of them are dead. One's long gone, and the other one I see on occasion. We get along okay now because we sort of let the past go away. But the things apparently weren't going very well with them running things. A lot of people objected to the way they did things, and at the AIDS walk that year, a couple people who were then, one new in the club and one somebody I'd known for years, pulled me aside at the AIDS walk and tried to talk me into coming back and running for office again. I said, And we finally cut a deal, and I showed up that summer and started just being nice. And I'm just here to dance. Come the election in the fall for the new board, I ran as for president, and I had talked to one of these other people who wanted me to run. Okay, if you'll run for this position, I'll do this. And I remember the night of the vote, they never did announce what the tally was, but I looked across the room and I could see the faces of these people who had shoved me out the door the year before, and it was unanimous shock on their faces. They simply expected to walk away with the election again because they were doing so great, and everybody else thought they were doing shit. So I won, and I was magnanimous in winning. One of them was to teach the basic class again that year. And I said, okay, well, just because you did this to me doesn't mean I'm going to do it to you, so by all means teach the class. And we eventually had to fire his ass, as he had decided that he was going to be a square dance caller. And he was using this class to teach himself to call. And I had to remind him continuously from week to week that these people are not here for you to learn how to call. They are here to learn to square dance. And if you can't teach them to square dance, then you're out. And out he went. And in that particular class was Scott Phillips, one of the other people that's being interviewed by your class. So Scott and I have known each other for a long time now. So yeah, there's, and at the association level, yes, I've managed to piss off more than one person, sometimes deliberately, sometimes accidentally. But yeah, there's been some occasional animosity there, particularly with one stupid son of a bitch from Los Angeles whose name is Paul Waters, but we don't speak his name because he's such an asshole. But it's nothing personal.
No, not at all. So you were speaking about the medallions. Have you won any type of award like such?
Yeah,
or?
Actually. In 2000, at the first convention, which I was not at, somebody took a pair of cowboy boots and spray painted them gold, and they were sort of an ornament, I guess, in front of the stage. But then somebody took one of those boots and gave it to a guy named Art Smith, as an award for having helped put all this together and what have you. The other boot, I can't say it was, well, melded is the term. The other boot was melded to the wire frame of a lampshade, and I don't know, a strainer of some sort, and turned into a crown, which eventually became the crown of the Honky Tonk Queen, which is another story of mine. But the boot that went to Art became the Golden Boot Award. And it was, the boot itself was passed along for a few years until Freeman Stamper got it, and then he sort of retired the thing and came up with these, just a little dangle. These are referred to as dangles. Came up with a little dangle like this. Mm-hmm. And what would happen is that the person who received the Golden Boot Award, because it wasn't an association award, it wasn't an official award, it wasn't anything, then it was their responsibility, if they wanted to select someone else the next year to receive the Golden Boot. So this has been going on, well, since 1985. And my turn came up in 2003, much to my surprise, and this Andy Shore, who had received it in 2002, mm-hmm. Had decided to give it to me. So this was his reasoning for passing the award along to me. And it's not you don't win it, you receive it.
You're the sofa.
when we did the convention in 98 here in Portland, I had a nice badge made up for myself.
Right.
And I had a second one made up since I had been the chair, that as soon as the convention was over, I switched that badge for one that said sofa. So I became the sofa.
That's cute.
And as he was reading this speech, since the idea is you don't identify the person, you sort of lead up to it.
Uh-huh.
When he said curmudgeon somewhere there toward the end, I realized, right. Oh shit, that's me. Mm-hmm. So it always, with a few rare exceptions, it always seems to come as a massive surprise to who's ever receiving it. Mm-hmm. And I discovered, I knew immediately who I was going to pass it on to. But, you know, on the way home on the airplane, I made my list of all the people I thought should be recognized this way, and the one name just kept coming back to the top. So I knew immediately who I was going to pass it to. I just had to wait for a year to do it. Mm-hmm. And I've talked to other people that have received it, and it's pretty much the same thing. You know immediately what you're going to do with it, but you just have to convince yourself that that really is the right decision. So, and it was very nice. I was quite shocked.
Now, would you consider that one of your proudest moments, or do you have other proud moments involved in the Rosetown Ramblers?
Yeah, well, that was a proud moment, and again, it's that sort of outside the Ramblers. Much of my square dancing involvement has gone beyond the Ramblers. Mm-hmm. For many years, I represented the Ramblers at the board meetings, until I finally talked somebody else into it, and I'm... Scott Phillips and I are now representing the Heads to the Center, which is the other gay square dance club here in Portland. The Ramblers, this got me, speaking of things that got me into trouble with the Ramblers, a group of us, the Ramblers do classes, basic classes, and mainstream classes, and plus, which is the first three levels or programs, however you want to think of them. There were a group of us that wanted to learn. Well, we learned advanced on our own. It was advanced one and two, and a group of us learned that 1 year. And then a small group of us wanted to learn challenge, which is the next level up. And we talked about it, thought, you know, the Ramblers can't really handle all this stuff. It's enough for them to do the basic mainstream and plus classes. They can't do a challenge class as well. So we went and found ourselves a caller and in somebody's basement, secretly, we didn't tell anybody we were doing it, learned the first level of challenge. When the Ramblers found out, they were very, very unhappy. Mm-hmm. Not only because we had done it secretly, which I never thought was really that good an idea anyway, and we did pay the price for that. But we were trying to destroy the Ramblers by forming this other club that was going to do advanced and challenge. It took a lot of convincing to get them beyond that. So now the Ramblers do the basic, mainstream, and plus, and Heads to the Center. The other club, we do the advanced classes, and we try to challenge class, but as you go up through these levels, fewer and fewer people want to keep going up there. So by the time you get to challenge, you've got a small group of people to work with. And even in the whole square dance, straight and gay community here in Portland, there aren't that many challenge dancers. So getting enough people together to do a class can be a problem. So we don't do it very often. But still, that was a major stink as far as the Ramblers are concerned, and it's taken them a while to just get over it and get used to it. Because the Heads to the Center wouldn't exist without the Rosetown Ramblers. Mm-hmm. So it behooves us to support the Rosetown Ramblers any way we can so that we've got square dancers coming in so that if anybody's interested in moving along, we've got a home for them when they get there.
I just wonder what you think, Rick, if if you think the Ramblers, or Heads to the Center, I guess, serve the same purpose, like, socially for gay and lesbian individuals that they did in the 80s?
No. No, for a lot of people, and me included, when I said that I wasn't that comfortable in the bars, a lot of people found square dancing as a much more relaxed way of meeting people. And we had a lot, and country western was coming into its own at the time, so people had that crossover interest. And these days, country western is fading, unfortunately. And the square dancing, it's a lengthy commitment of time to learn square dancing. You know, it can take 6 months, and you know, a night a week for 6 months, and plus a monthly square dance, so that you've got a chance to practice your growing skills. And a lot of people just won't make that commitment anymore. And the entire square dance community, gay, straight, has been suffering over this for years. The straight national convention that was here in Portland in the late 90s, I think, had like 30,000 people. And one of their more recent national straight conventions couldn't quite get 10,000.
Oh, wow.
It's dying rapidly. A lot of the problem is that the older people involved in the straight community, they're used to that, it's been referred to as the 50s party style dresses, that they won't give them up. They won't give up that their rules, generally at the national, at many of their larger events and at their national conventions, you aren't even allowed in the building unless, as a woman, you are wearing an appropriate skirt, which is either what's called a prairie skirt or the big thing with the crinolines. Mm-hmm. And the men have to be wearing long pants and preferably a long-sleeved shirt, but maybe not necessarily these days. No jeans.
Oh, wow.
So a lot of people are put up with that nonsense. They don't want me the way I want to dress. I'm not going. The gay community, on the other hand, we don't give a shit. Wear what you want, or don't. We don't care if you're gay or straight. We don't care if you're or gay, straight. We had an ongoing fight for years over the name of the association, which is the International Association of Gay Square Dance Clubs. Well, lesbian. So it's now International Association of Gay Square Dance Clubs, a lesbian and gay organization. Then there was a move to slip transgendered in there. That was another one that got me into trouble. Because it's, oh, give it a fucking rest. It is what it is. Just so we're holding our own. We're not. We have clubs popping up even as clubs die for lack of support. But the straight world, it's just collapsing. You know, because of the costumes, because of the time commitment, and they're trying all sorts of things to get the time commitment shorter, all different sort of lessons plans to get this and get people dancing. They just can't quite seem to give up the clothing rule, which is just stupid. Where was I going with that? Somewhere. I was just complaining. But, oh, yeah. The world's changed since the 80s, for sure, and we're much more visible, more comfortably visible than we were at the time, much less ghettoized, for sure. And there are lots of other things to do. And square dancing is still, always has been, has that reputation as just being kind of weird and corny. It's actually not so much a physical exercise, although you can get quite a bit of physical exercise out of it, depending on what you're doing, but it's much more a combination of intellectual and physical. You have to be aware of what's going on, you have to be aware of what seven other people are doing around you, you have to know what you're supposed to do. And you've learned all these calls, but the way the caller spits them out at you, there's no pre-planning to that. You don't know what's coming next. You might assume you do, And you might get away with that most of the time with some experience, but then you'll be thrown for a loop at the wrong time because you thought you knew what was coming next and you didn't. So, I've square danced with people as old as 95 who might have been a little slow, but their brains were still working and they could still power through it all.
Wow.
And one of the... one of our regular callers, who lives in BC, she used to drag her son along all the time. So he's been surrounded by gay square dancing since he was just a little kid, and it's never been any problem for him. And he loves to dance. So it's a wide range of straight, gay, very young, very old, and there's room for everybody.
So you touched on it a little bit, but what is your current role in the association? What do you do for them? And
officially, I am the medallion stepmother.
Okay.
Stepmother, as I was telling you, because the person who originated this project, which is really a glorified attendance award, once he got it up and rolling in 90... Well, about 97, he's made it known that, okay, he'd done his part. Now, if this was going to keep going, somebody else was going to have to pick it up and do it because he was done. And apparently nobody he favored came rushing forward, and he called me one night and beat me about the head and shoulders. and it took me a couple of weeks. I finally agreed to take it over. So since 98, 99... I have been the stepmother of the Medallion Project, which again involves getting the data from each convention, keeping track of everyone who has attended a convention. And at their 10th convention, they receive a medallion with their name and the city they receive it in engraved on the back.
Oh, wow.
And there have been, you've been running about about 50 people a year get that. Then as of 2003, which was the 20th convention, I had to do something. So I had to recognize the people who had received, who had attended 20 conventions, again engraved on the back. And in between a couple of people, 25 is a much more important date than 30. Why should we have to wait so now every year? Some people have to get a 25, and in a couple more years, there'll be a small group of people who will have attended 30 of our annual conventions, and they'll receive something for that. The idea originally was that the gay community wasn't really known for dedication or commitment to anything. So Freeman had decided that anybody who was sufficiently dedicated or committed enough to our activity to have attended 10 conventions should be given a recognition of some sort. And I've been surprised in doing it that people now make it a goal. You know, they want to attend their 10 conventions so they can get their medallion. So even if they are otherwise disinclined to square dance, they'll still make the annual convention their vacation, so that they can get another year towards getting that medallion.
Now, does that include the design of the medallions as well, or is that a...
How so?
Well, I mean, do you design the medallion?
Freeman designed the original 10-year one with the interlocking squares and whatever the hell he put here on the back. So we've kept that design, even though this is one of the originals, which was made of some sort of pot metal by friends of his who were in the plumbing business. I had to have more made, and they were made by a stamping process at some factory in Mexico somewhere or other, and I'm looking at having to have more made, so I'm going to have to find that again. The 20-year, which I did design, is actually the fob of a keychain. I couldn't find what I wanted anywhere else and saw these keychains So I take the key ring part of it off and just keep the fob.
Uh-huh.
And I've got a, there's a business out in Lake Oswego. Getting things engraved is interesting. Generally speaking, if you don't purchase something from a shop, they will not do the engraving for you. To find an engraver who will engrave what you bring is rare. So this shop will engrave whatever I bring him. He gives me a, rather than charging me per letter, which is what they usually do, he gives me a flat rate for as many as I've got. Engraves the design on the front of these and does the engraving on the back. These, one of the things about square dancing is badge makers. Mm-hmm. Clearly, people get badges. The Files, husband and wife, in a badge making business, they travel around to square dance events everywhere and have their various square dance badges, and they make individual ones up because they have the cutting equipment with them. They do a lot of business with Disney. Joanne and Bob, they were getting older, and one of Joanne's sons, who happened to be gay, has pretty much taken over the business he and his partner have. So now, to get badges made, we call the boys. And in this case, since I had to do something for 25 and I didn't want to get involved in more ribbons, again, I came up with a fairly simple design that they could do on their machines as a plastic badge with a magnet on the back. So I count these up, decide how many I need, and email the boys and tell them how many I need, and they'll have them for me when I get to convention.
Nice.
And for years, when I took over the project from Freeman, it was with the understanding Freeman was a manager in a law office, so I've got all sorts of legal paperwork, which gives me all right, claim, and title to the medallion project, so that I actually own it. And in owning it for most of the years I was doing it, the money to do it came out of my pocket for buying the ribbon, getting the engraving done. And it was a bit of a stretch some years. But since it wasn't an official association project, then I gladly paid for it. It was no big deal. The board of the association finally talked me into accepting money from them. So now when I get it done, I just ordered another 36 of the 20s. And that's going to cost me $500. And when we get to the convention, I will have presented my list of expenses, and then they'll write me a check to cover them. So. And this way, since I don't want to keep doing this forever, I'm not desperately yet looking for somebody to take over, but I plan on going through the 30s, and after the 30s, if somebody else doesn't step up, well, that's going to be the end of that, because I'm not going to keep doing it. But by letting the association pay for it, then I'm taking the financial burden off of talking somebody else into taking it over.
Right.
Who that might be, I don't know. It needs somebody with a certain amount of personality, who doesn't have any trouble standing up in front of 1,000 people,
right,
and can also keep track of the data, get the ribbons made, get the medallions engraved, get all this stuff carted around the country. I used to carry it. But with the, they were getting too damn heavy, but with the TSA, if you send something through the x-ray machine, you know, there are 50 of these, and the x-ray machine sees this shape.
Mm-hmm.
Now, can you imagine what the shape looks like? It looks like a hand grenade. As I was talking to one of the TSA people in Phoenix, coming back with those, and I asked, well, that's what they thought. Oh, it looks like hand grenade. I've decided at that point, okay, I'm not going to carry the damn things anymore. Now I find somebody who's at the convention location, and I ship them ahead UPS, and they can have them there for me, and I don't have to worry about all that nonsense.
Yeah.
But life just gets ever more complicated.
<It's>, yeah.
Other highlights.
Yeah.
Let's see. These two badges represent the two Portland conventions, and I designed those.
Oh, fun.
This one, I had to fight. See how the star sticks off the side there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, that's gonna catch in people's clothes, and it's gonna tear stuff, and people would be cut. And that was at least one of the occasions during this where I said, "Fine, do it your way," but I quit. I said, "Well, no, you don't have to quit. Just do it your way." So I got away with that, and then just to nail the point in, 10 years later, when we did it again, it's nothing but points. So.
Oh, that's pretty.
I do like to get my own petty little revenge. And the vest, which we don't do anymore, unfortunately. Somebody got the idea one year for these vests. With the rose on the front, and the Rambler's logo on the back, which it's beautifully done, but the vest costs some money, and the embroidery was costing a fortune, so they finally gave up on that. Mm. And I don't know who did the original design. I've never known. It's been updated. It's been fixed up a couple of times because the original is long gone. And we keep getting photocopies of photocopies of photocopies. So every now and then it has to be done over. And I've done it over myself a couple of times. Once I had a computer and the graphics program, getting everything straightened up. So that's always something else to do. Mm-hmm. And... One of the other things I've done for the Ramblers is for several years, and again on and off, I did the newsletter, which gave me an excuse to not only waste time at work, but also use equipment that the state had that I couldn't afford.
Right.
At that time, anyway.
Thank you.
So what do you see as your future with them or the association? Where do you want to go?
Well, now that I'm retired, it gives me more opportunity to travel, and I would like to go traveling to see some of the other clubs once I get this thing under control. I would like... Some of us have... It's an ongoing joke. We pay our registration to go to convention every year.
Right.
We don't dance. I'm going to Chicago this year, and I'll have the microphone on 3 or 4 occasions. Mm-hmm. I'll be sitting at my table having people check in with me for the medallion stuff, and I will print out the entire database so people can come and make corrections, which is always necessary. So I'll spend most of my time sitting around socializing and never get to dance. Mm-hmm. And there are a number of individuals like that, and our joke is that we should be able to pay the non-dancer fee to attend the convention.
Yeah.
We don't get the chance to. I'd like to get the chance to dance again. And not be in charge of something and not have to go to the board meetings. And I enjoy them. But after... this is my 25th convention this year. After 25 of these, you know... I want to square dance... It's nice being involved. It's nice having a measure of control over what happens, mm-hmm. or having people defer to you because they either enjoy your experience or they're afraid of you. Mm-hmm. I'd like to relax at some point. And as it is, we're. Conventions in Chicago, 4th of July weekend this year, and I have a bunch of stuff to do there as usual. The board meeting's on Thursday. I have to catch up with people, get the 20s. People doing the 25s are going to lead the Grand March if I can herd them in and talk them into doing it. I have to do a presentation then. I have to do a presentation at the banquet. God only knows where I'll get involved in the board meeting. Plus, because I've been around so long and I know everybody, I tend to be politically connected with everybody, so things get run past me, that's wonderful. It's nice to feel important like that. A big fish in a relatively small pond, and nothing really earth-shaking to come out of it. But it's fun and keeps me amused. But once that convention is over, 4th of July weekend, then I'm back here, and Scott Phillips, who's another one that your class is talking to. And I are doing the West Coast Gay Advanced and Challenge Weekend at the end of September out at the airport hotel, at the airport Sheraton. So we've got the hotel contract signed, we've got the caller contract signed, we've we've got half of the people that we need have already paid for it. Now we have to hustle the other half before the bills start coming due. So we've got that to do. Then there's the Ramblers fall fly-in, which is at the end of October, and whatever else I can stick my finger in. So there's always something to do, and I don't mind. Yes, I do like being on top of the organization.
Yeah. So just in conclusion, you know, people are going to be listening to this maybe some in the future. Is there one thing that you would like anyone to know about you or the Rosetown Ramblers or the association that you want to
if
tell
you could
anybody?
Sum it up.
Yeah.
Square dancing is actually fun. It's a good social activity. If you're a little shy, it's fine. You've got seven other people you have to work with. You've got a subject in common you can talk about. So it's a great social opportunity. It's good exercise for the brain and for the body. And I'm probably typically, well, yeah, that's what I like about square dancing. That's what other people should give it a try. It's fun. Me, well, like I said, I've made a great many friends. I've probably made a few enemies, and sometimes deliberately, not always deliberately. I've enjoyed the experience. I like it. I want to keep doing it. As long as I can.
Nice.
Right. Turn the thing on.